Welcome to Federal Insights, sponsored by Pegasystems.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Eric White. Whether you're crossing one of the U.S. borders or just walking through an airport, many citizens have experienced the Homeland Security Department's use of artificial intelligence technologies, whether they know it or not. But with such a wide swath of responsibilities, how does the agency know what areas to utilize these relatively new tools? To get a sense of how they do that, I got the chance to speak with Dr. Amy Henninger. She's a senior engineering advisor for advanced computing with DHS's Science and Technology Directorate.
I would start out by saying that AI is somewhat nascent at DHS. We're really just starting to get into it in a big way. And I think that's demonstrated by the recent stand-up of the AI task force, right? And that task force, jointly led by our boss, Undersecretary Kuznetsov, and the CIO, CIO Heisen, has really received guidance from our secretary on high priority applications. So what smart people are doing is working very hard to understand those application areas and pick the projects that where we think we have the most bang for the buck, right? And those priorities coming from the S1 through the AI task force is looking at applications related to border security, supply chain security, disruption of fentanyl or synthetic opioid production, very interested in digital forensic and combating online child exploitation. We're very interested in adversarial AI, the types of AI security above and beyond cybersecurity that AI enables new attack surfaces for. And then we're looking at AI applied to critical infrastructure, very interested in foundation models, and then AI infrastructure, of course. And then everybody, and especially the federal government, has to be very concerned with responsible AI and understanding how that's going to be implemented within the scope of their domain.
Yeah, so you mentioned some of those high priority areas. Can you take me through a little bit of the decision-making process there? I know that you said that, you know, it's a collaborative effort, but how do you go about deciding where or what is a high priority task for where AI could be applied? Is there a certain test that you all bring forth, or are there just certain things that you see problems and AI might be able to help and they're important problems to solve?
Well, I think right now it's because it is nascent, it's really sort of a combination of a lot of different factors and approaches. You know, as a general methodology, personally, I've always been a big fan of the Heilmeier catechism, right? So what are you trying to do? What are the limitations of the current practice? What's new in your approach? Who cares? So it's very sort of DARPA-esque. But there are a high order features, attributes that you have to be aware of when you're going through this, right? So what's the value proposition? What's the problem you're trying to solve? What are the pain points? Is it technically feasible, right? Does it provide sufficient value, which in my view is better, faster, cheaper? What's the return on investment? And then importantly, like we talked about before, is it compatible with the longer term strategic vision and higher order guidance, right? So all those project topics that I talked about before, of course, they're sort of automatically given higher priority. But I guess the other thing you have to make sure you have access to appropriate data in terms of quality, quantity, you know, sufficiency. If you don't have that for your AI project, it's pretty much just dead on arrival. And then we have to make sure it's consistent with ethical and regulatory considerations, right? So those are kind of big muscle movements, I'd say, for making those kinds of decisions. And there's such a broad swath of places where AI could be applied that it's really a matter of sort of coming up with the use cases, understanding the requirements, looking at those kinds of things I talked about, and then racking and stacking them according to the resources you have to work with to make improvements. And importantly, as you make those improvements and as you stand up AI-enabled capabilities across the department, we would expect some degree of savings from that, which could then in turn be reinvested to create more AI opportunities in other places.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is how do you gauge success? Is it the better, faster, cheaper methodology that you apply to seeing as a successful implementation of a new AI application? Or it's so new, are you just looking for any sort of gains when it comes to those areas?
So to me, the trade space is better, faster, cheaper, right? And I don't know that the department has a definitive way of looking at this yet, other than taking into account all those things I talked about before and weighing them against each other. But in my view, you know, if you don't improve at least one of those things, oh, by the way, without reducing the quality of service in the other two, right? So if I get better, but I lose faster or cheaper, then maybe I haven't done as much as I thought. So, for example, if we were to develop an automated chatbot capability, and it is designed to increase throughput at an emergency center, right? The calls at an emergency center. Let's say it does that, but it does that at the expense of a lot of frustrated people or customers, right? Citizens calling it and saying, well, that chatbot isn't very good. Then that's not really much of an improvement. So the metric has to be comprehensive and not sort of overly myopic. But, you know, there's every project has a higher order metric, you know, get travelers through security at airports more quickly, improve capabilities to do information synthesis in a threat hunting exercise, improve detection of AI-enabled swatting, right? So there's always sort of a higher order project metric. But then, you know, that breaks down, right? So all projects have they're at different points in the project life cycle, and they could have different goals in different parts of the life cycle. And then they have different sort of layers within the project of sub goals, right? And sub goals. So, you know, all of them have KPIs and KPPs, and you can consider all those some form of goal. So at DHS, our applications have a long list of ILITIs. So you can look at our AI strategy and see a very long list of ILITIs that we have to be compliant with. And in some ways, each one of those is a goal in and of itself. So there are a lot of different levels of goals, a lot of different places for goals. But in my view, you know, the ultimate is it better, faster, or cheaper without losing any ground in the other two?
You brought up the making sure that the customers, or, you know, folks trying to cross the border, or citizens that interact with DHS, let's not forget the workforce too, right? The people implementing the technology need to be happy with it as well. Where does that come into play, and how do you differentiate between, you know, AI projects focused on just regular agency operations and those that actually have constituent facing services?
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent question. And, you know, I've only been at DHS a little over a year myself. So that formally from the DOD and the IC, right? So this idea of I have these sort of internal facing projects and external facing projects, that's a little bit different for me, even just stepping into the DHS ecosystem. So in my view, the biggest differentiator really is the degree to which the citizen is actively involved in engaging the AI capability, right? So public-facing AI projects, for example, will have a greater degree of interaction with the public, probably public-facing APIs, right? So think of the chatbot again, helping to facilitate some kind of administrative service, like navigating a bureaucratic process or providing translation capabilities. They have that direct interface to the public, and that interface is accessible to the public and used by the public. So these projects will deploy AI in systems that are accessible through websites or mobile phones or, you know, some kind of communications channel. On the other hand, you know, if you look at something like a biometrics application or a cargo scanning application or predictive models to entities on the southern border, you know, they're using data generated by the public, but not necessarily models that are accessible to the public, right? So they wouldn't have an API that the public interfaces with. I think probably, you know, things like user experience, user design, that's going to be important to both. But my sense is that it's probably even more important to the citizen-facing projects. And that might not be true 100% of the time. But of course, we have to make sure everything is explainable and interpretable by operators or by citizens. So that does sort of cover both of those domains. But I still feel like in terms of being sort of user friendly, it's even more important for the general citizenry. And then I think data usage probably might be a little different. So the operations-focused AI might focus a little bit more on classified data or law enforcement-sensitive data, which you wouldn't probably not see in a citizen-facing AI project. And those projects, I think, would be more in tune with seeing, you know, public data providing information services or assistance, and probably more strongly emphasize accessibility. And of course, like before, you know, privacy is a consideration essential for both of those courses. But I think the focus of internally facing versus externally facing just warrants sort of different emphases otherwise. So to circle back, I guess, to the beginning on my original comment, I really think the biggest difference is just the degree of access and how these models are used and interfaced by either the citizen or the operator.
Yeah, it sounds as if what you're saying is that if the operator has their efforts improved or their, you know, their job easier, that's going to, it's a chain reaction, right? It'll improve the citizen facing application that is being used, correct? Or am I making it sound too simple?
No, I think you're raising a great point. So if a TSA operator can evaluate and scan baggage more quickly, right, the citizen is going to benefit from that ultimately. So I think there is some kind of chain reaction. And then we have sort of direct citizen interactions that could improve also. But anything that we improve for the operator really ultimately is done because we're a public institution. It's always done with the intent of improving things for national security writ large, which is ultimately for our citizens.
That's Dr. Amy Henninger, Senior Engineering Advisor for Advanced Computing with the Homeland Security Department Science and Technology Directorate. We'll be back with more of this interview after a quick break. I'm Eric White.
Are outdated processes slowing your agency down? Now is the moment to lean into rapid AI-driven innovation to boost productivity across the full customer journey. With PegaGen AI, AI and automation do the heavy lifting so your team can focus on the mission. And with enterprise-ready governance built in, you can innovate with confidence. Learn how Pega is putting the citizen and the mission at the center of AI-powered decisioning. Visit pega.com/govAI.
Welcome back. We continue our interview with Dr. Amy Henninger, Senior Engineering Advisor for Advanced Computing for the Homeland Security Department Science and Technology Directorate. And let's talk about the big part of AI that most people don't realize, and that is just, it's almost only as good as the data that you get. Can you take me through, you talked a little bit about it when you mentioned it, the ethical considerations when it comes to data, especially that law enforcement sensitive data and just the biometric data that on a daily basis DHS is getting an ungodly amount of.
So that's a great question. And again, like coming into a DHS from the DOD, that was really sort of a whole new thing for me to get used to, right, and to understand. So, and I can report as a citizen, I am thrilled and so grateful that DHS is as careful with our data, our private data, as we are. So I was a little bit shocked at all the oversight and regulations and policies making sure that our data as citizens is kept private, anonymized, not used in ways that we wouldn't want it used. So DHS has gone to great lengths to make sure that happens. But you know, data considerations for training AI in general, there's a ton of them, right? Data quality, right? We have to make sure the data is accurate and complete. The quantity, you have to make sure you have sufficient amounts of the data, and it has to be balanced in such a way that it meets generalization requirements for the project. It has to be representative and relevant to the current context, again, to support all the generalization requirements, to data privacy and security like we talked about, you know, has to be anonymizable if it's used, you know, has to protect the individual's privacy, all sorts of compliance with data privacy regulations like HIPAA, ethical guidelines when using and handling data, all sorts of policies on who owns the data, how long are you allowed to retain the data for before you have to delete it, data governance processes, you know, how is it stored, how is it managed, being responsible for it, like I said before, the retaining of it. And then, you know, the accessibility, you have to do version control, and then tons of pre-processing work, right? So all the normalization, the augmentation of the data, checking data periodically to make sure it's free of bias, and then ensuring that you have high quality labels. So it's a big challenge for both the AI projects and for the government implementing the AI projects. And I've worked, like I said, in the DOD on the IC and now at DHS, and getting, even just getting the data to be visible and accessible and cleansed, it's a really, really big job. And it's a job that requires dogged persistence and longevity. And it's one of those jobs that you get noticed when things go wrong, but you don't always get a lot of attention if things are going right. So it takes a really special personality to make significant progress in that line of effort and getting that data pulled together to support these projects.
I want to zero in on the data quality and ensuring that bias doesn't creep into any sets of data that you may have. If you could just talk a little bit more about how you ensure that the data is of use. And also, I'd like to pick your brain on, you know, coming from the IC, what the risks are now being at DHS. You know, what could bias do from the IC side of things? And from your position now, what do you see as the main warning signs that comes up whenever bias could creep in?
Yeah, so bias creeping in over time is, I think, the operative word, right? So, because that scopes the kind of bias that you're interested in, right? So for example, we could be developing a classifier to detect potential for heart attacks within the next year. And if we oversample the male population relative to the female population, we've introduced bias, right? But that's not necessarily bias that creeps in over time. That's just bias that happened at data creation, sort of a form of sampling bias. And I suppose if you kept that methodology and used it over time, then you could consider it creeping in over time. But I don't think that's what you're asking about here. I think what you're asking about is probably more about like data drift or model drift type of bias, which is more in tune with the sense of manifesting over time, although I'm sure there's probably others. So on a small time scale, like back to my dissertation days when I was doing a dissertation, you know, I implemented my machine learning algorithm in a closed loop system. And in a closed loop system, your model's outputs can impact the world state and the model state, which in turn become inputs to your next model inference cycle. So you have to be very, very careful about watching for unstable trajectories, because the model and execution starts to diverge from the initial training data sets in ways that are hard for the model to correct for. But that's kind of a specialized application. And in the context of DHS use cases, at least, I think data drift is probably the bigger concern. And data drift occurs when the distribution of the incoming data changes over time, right? Leading to a mismatch between the training data and the real world data used for predictions, right? So you could imagine, you know, some anomaly detection model being trained on traffic patterns at the border, okay? But over time, these patterns could shift, right? Perhaps there's some economic shift or changes in trade agreements or something. So over time, there's a significant increase in trucks coming over the border, which is different than what the model was originally trained on, right? So all of a sudden, we have sort of a drift in the data that the model was originally devised to accommodate versus data that it's actually being introduced to now, right? So that's like one kind of drift. And you can protect that with things like instrumenting your algorithm with different metrics and monitoring tools. You can look at periodically retraining your algorithm with new data, right, to adapt adapt to the changing ecosystem and the preferences. There are bias detection mitigations that you can do during retraining. There are tools that you can use to help monitor this. And then you can just do, you know, audits and assessments of the algorithms and the output. You can continuously update your data, your training data set, establish feedback mechanisms from the user. So there's a lot of things you can do to kind of guard against that, but that is a problem. And then another kind of drift really that is related, but not the exact same, is concept drift, right? And that's also very important for DHS. So in concept drift, this is what happens when the underlying relationships between the input variables and the target variables change, right? So in this one, you know, imagine that you have an AI application that detects suspicious behavior at an airport security checkpoint, right? And it's trained on things like historical passenger behavior, baggage screening results, security personnel actions, all those kinds of things. But things can change over time, right? We develop new CONOPs or new threats or new TTPs, new trends. So, you know, maybe, you know, we figure out a way to let people bring peanut butter on planes, right? Well, this kind of breaks the old model. So that's a sort of concept drift where you have to now go back and sort of update your model as a result of that. In terms of biases, drifts with respect to DHS and the IC, well, they have very different authorities for different kinds of data sources. At DHS, we would be very, very interested in making sure that, sort of like that example I gave before with, you know, the heart attacks, we would be very, very interested in making sure that there's no bias due to different attributes of people, especially under, you know, protection. Race, gender, religion, that kind of thing, and making sure that our algorithms were free of bias from that context. And then drift, I think, you know, that might apply if there were changes or shifts in any of those subpopulations with respect to the model. We would have to make sure that we paid attention to that and represented it accurately in updates of the model.
Got it. And my last question here is part of my own curiosity. Does monitoring the data sets for any bias or drift possibilities, is it still worth it in the end? Is it going to get to a point where you're monitoring so much data that the AI, you know, it gets back to that faster, cheaper, better thing? Is there a certain point where you're just saturated with so much, then you have to monitor it so much that it's almost making it harder to actually get what you want out of it?
Well, that's an excellent question, Eric, and a really great observation. I think the answer is going to have to be yes. And that doesn't mean there won't be points of inflection we have to go through or some uncomfortableness that we have to go through to get there. But kind of given the speed at which things are going to be moving, ultimately there's going to be a lot of automation in everything, right? Because, you know, the other thing we didn't talk about is that all these systems are also susceptible to adversarial attacks, right? So we talked a little bit about cybersecurity attacks. Well, all of these AI-based systems especially can be tricked or spoofed or manipulated in nefarious ways. And that's going to be automated, right? This adversarial AI is going to be automated. So we're going to have the automation to counter that at the speed of relevance. And because that automation is going to happen over time, there'll become a time where it becomes easier for us to do that kind of large-scale monitoring that you asked the question about, because we will have the automation in place. But that, you know, it doesn't happen overnight.
That's Dr. Amy Henninger, Senior Engineering Advisor for Advanced Computing for DHS's Science and Technology Directorate. You can find this interview on our website. Head to federalnewsnetwork.com and search Federal Insights. I'm Eric White.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights, sponsored by Pegasystems on Federal News Network.